Hello and welcome to ANK's Wheel of Time podcast, where we are going through a chapter-by-chapter review of the Wheel of Time books. And today we're doing Book 1, Chapter 15, Strangers and Friends. Now, as far as just to recap a little bit out the tail end of the last chapter, because it very much is relevant to what happens next, is Rand has just had a pretty freaky ass dream, where
like a dreamscape.
Yeah, you know, like a dreamscape thing. I mean, it would, we're calling it a dreamscape for lack of a better word at the moment. And he's didn't get much sleep after that. Kind of very restless. Well,
he got a deep but restless sleep.
Yeah. After
and,
that,
and it seems to have created a headache. He's not feeling that great.
Which is not too surprising.
Yeah, that's true. But see now. The thing that came, because there is one thing that I picked up on, because I reread the last chapter and I just went, hang on, he seems to think that, he's hinting at the fact that a whalesman, that he doesn't know who he is, and that he's trying to get him to remember who he is.
Kind of like a past life thing?
Yeah. Reincarnation thing, and it could be for now when you find out that obviously he wasn't the only one, because immediately pretty much
but it's a little time later because he goes to the kitchen first.
He gets food, sees an argument, whoop-de-doo.
Well, just saying, let's get the order right.
Oh, come on.
Okay. I know I mess things up, you know, at least at times, but he gets up, gets dressed and goes down to the kitchen,
discovers all the rats are dead. The cat's been complained about.
Hey, the
personally,
rats are dead.
I would love the fact that the rats are dead. Who the hell complains about dead rats?
Well, not only that, but that is actually kind of a key thing, considering that was also part of the dreamscape.
Yeah, I know,
but their
things, you know, snap. And I get that, but still, you know, to complain about a dead rat as being, I'd rather it dead than sleeping in my bed, you know?
Or rather dead and rotting in your bed?
No, not dead and rotten in the bed. That would be gross. But it wasn't in the bed.
Well, we don't know where they were.
They were all over the place.
Exactly. Who knows? One could have died in the bed.
Still, I'm just saying.
It's a fair reason for a complaint. You get a dead rat smell.
It's just being killed that night.
Yeah, well.
They don't smell that fast.
How do you know?
Well, any rotting corpse takes a while before it smells. That's a fact.
Anyway, moving on. We've had this little thing, and then Rand gets to have a bit of a conversation with the...
He sees the argument between the major and the cook about...
Which in and of itself is kind of comical.
It is, yeah, because all of a sudden he starts fighting her for the apron to stay on. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of comical. You can cook for them then. And he's like, "Whoa, wait, no, the cat can stay, but so can you."
And then as, Rand gets, in modern days, or in reality, kind of a special treatment kind of thing to be able to eat in the kitchen and, you know, just get some fairly basic fare because Chef has only recently started and only starting to put food together for the day.
No, because the others were up and had breakfast already.
No, it's still too early for that.
No, it's not. He woke up late.
No.
Reread the chapter again, dude. I'm telling
you. She went until he was gone. I suppose you want something to eat, huh? Well, come on in. I don't bite no matter what, da-da-da. Sarah gets some bread and cheese and milk. That's all there is right now. And then the very next sentence. Your friends will go, okay, fine, I stand corrected, dear listeners. My apologies.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Reread the chapter. Are you sure you can do it?
I'll be quiet.
Have you read the whole chapter?
Anyway, so he finds out during that, during the conversation there that the rats' backs were broken, which was exactly the same way that they were killed in his dream, which, tends to, I won't say freak him out, but it's kind of getting him to go, what the?
Yeah, well, there was several of them. There wasn't just one either. It was actually several.
And at that, And it's also during that conversation that the cook tells him that everyone barring one, he's not quite sure, you know, he hasn't been told which at this point, but all but one of his compatriots have gone out in, into the city. And he's starting to think, you know, maybe I need to talk to someone about this, about the dream that I had. I'm not quite sure who I want to talk to. Not Mistress Alice / Moraine at this point, because I'm scared of how she'll react. And also, the only one that he's willing to trust at this point would be, Tom the Gleeman. But he's in the middle of the story, and so he doesn't
want
to disturb him. He starts to listen to some of the Gleeman story, but doesn't really stay there for too long. And then he realized that he just needs to get some air. He needs to go out and
no,
correction, sorry. Jumping the gun on them.
He remembers that he's got a friend.
Yes, he does.
Somewhere, so he goes to discover who.
Yep. So he goes upstairs back to the room, and he sees that it's Perrin. Of the in terms of sensibility, I call Perrin, as far as to use a bit of a Lord of the Rings comparison, and yes, dear listeners, you can tick off one of your little bingo boxes that you may have put together. But I would count Perrin to be the Pippin of the two, I suppose.
Yeah, that's good enough.
But anyway, he's...
The dream definitely takes more out of him than everyone else. This is where he discovers that he wasn't the only one who had the dream.
Or was part of that dreamscape. Yeah. Or had, wasn't the only one to have that experience. And it really shook Perrin up, rather understandably, because that was not, certainly a freaky dream or dreamscape that they had. He's not quite sure what to do about it at the moment. They both agree not to talk to Moraine about it. For the moment.
He was undecided. They were undecided. They didn't say no, definitely.
Not an outright no, but they were certainly cautious on the idea. Yeah. Of doing so. And they think that Matt had a similar had a similar dream. They're not certain because they haven't had a chance to talk to him about it yet, but they think
he did. Well, he had him moaning in the night.
Yeah. So they...
basically, he lays back...
They both agree that they're going to talk to Tom about it, though. But again, it's... it's going to hold off on that a little bit as well.
No, they don't. They don't have that conversation. He just lays back down and he goes out.
Yes.
They don't agree to talk to Tom about it. He just says, I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet, and I'm going back to sleep. Good night.
Yeah, no, fair point. But he does actually state, do you think we can trust Tom? If we can trust anybody around? Yeah. No, it's going to be him. So, and he also, I love the next line there. If we ever get back home, if you ever hear me talking about leaving Emmonsfield ever again, kick me.
Even as far as the Widow where it was, they went.
Watch Hill.
Yeah, Watch Hill, that's it. Even as far as that, kick me. Yeah.
Like, I'm done with the event. I can't believe I left.
Yeah. Isn't that always the way, though? I mean, Frodo, he actually never wanted to leave to begin with. He knew the value of home, and yet every other person who went out and adventured in book series and things like that valued and missed home after they had left it and didn't realise what they had until it was gone. Hmm. And it's so much, very much the way. And with some characters, of course, they develop and they get better and they gain so much more, and home becomes a part of a learning experience. But for others, it's like, I should never have left home. I want to go back there, kind of thing.
And not only that, though, but, I love Sam's speech at the end of Two Towers, too. What?
No, I don't recall it. What's
the whole bit? Wow, has it really been that long since you've watched it? Okay. Note to, dear listeners, this is what we're going to be doing tonight. Going through the trilogy again. Ha! Anyway.
Is it on where he's at the watch? If y'all can't carry you, I'll carry
no,
you.
That's no, the that's third movie.
The third movie.
Second,
I don't know which talk you're talking
it's
about.
It's like the stories, the stories that really mattered, where people had a chance to turn back, only they didn't.
Okay.
That whole speech. While I know we're still extremely early on in the series, in my mind, when it comes to, the great stories and whatnot, and, that kind of a reference, there's a lot of points where people can turn back, where people can say, I've had enough, I want to turn around, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like
with Frodo, with getting to the Elven City, he had a choice. He could leave the ring there and go back home and be completely apart from the entire situation, or he could continue on.
Yeah.
And
To name one,
yeah. Yeah. And he had several points. He had several moments where he could turn back or give it up or let someone else take the burden.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose not to. He was tempted many times.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yes.
I
imagine that this is going to be a similar situation for them, is that they're going to be given these opportunities or these experiences and be tempted to do certain things and have a choice to either do it or not, and either hold on to the burden of needing to go to keep something safe or to keep to fight for something, and then have to choose to turn back.
Agreed. Now, after that, and he finds out that that this wasn't a solo dreamscape, he kind of leaves the room, shaken a little bit, takes a few moments to kind of compose himself.
Well, he also feels a little relieved that he wasn't the only one that had the
too.
Dream. But that also freaks him out as well, because it's like, okay, well, if we're having the same dream, is there more to it? And so it's kind of a bit freaky that way for him, because he doesn't want to have it be real, but he also feels comforted in knowing that he's not going crazy because he's not the only one experiencing it.
Well, there's that too. So after, and when it's after he takes that moment to get himself back together, and he kind of gets noticed in the hallway a little bit by people walking past, he's like, yeah, I need to just walk and get. This is where he would decide to walk to get some air.
He doesn't feel well enough to go anywhere.
No, but he just needs to get some air.
He doesn't want to leave Perrin by himself because the Gleeman's going to be leaving soon enough after his story. And it didn't feel right for him to leave him. So, he just hangs around.
Goes outside the kitchen and just stays on the porch kind of. Stays by the back porch kind of area.
Yeah.
Which also ends up being near the stable yard. And he looks out and just gets his first look to see what a busy midday, of sorts, kind of bail on is like. And he realizes that I don't know where any of you listeners are, but I'm picturing New York on a busy afternoon. I am picturing, for us anyway, say Sydney on a, middle of Sydney City, kind of, on a busy afternoon, kind of mid-Christmas kind of thing, where people are all clammed together like sardines, trying to get to the get to the shop or whatever that they're trying to get to. And he realizes no one here knows each other, but it's a city that is very, very packed. Yeah, while he's looking at that, he's also kind of, he's also being noticed by the stableman, who's kind of looking at him, went back inside, kind of gave him a, comes back out again, gives him a second glance. They look at each other once or twice, but, he's stunned at how busy the city is. Doesn't feel like quite going out there at the moment because, what if, he doesn't, as you know, Kylie correctly said, you know, it's, you know, Perrin, he doesn't want to leave Perrin, and what if Tom finishes, and he loses the opportunity to be able to talk to him about, you know, about his experience. And he doesn't want to go back in with his headache, so he just sits down and
meets the most interesting person called Min. I love this girl.
This is a crazy woman.
I love this girl.
She's nuts.
She's the angel, you know, an Angela of the Aragorn series.
Okay. Kind of thing, yeah, no, she's like that. Angela. I'll pay that.
Not as funny. And definitely not as quirky in terms of...
Well, I don't know. Why do we get the feeling, wait for it from her? This is just the introduction. I mean, we don't get the same kind of crazy introduction. For those who have who haven't read the Aragorn series, the books are far better than the movie.
Oh, I was so disappointing when I saw the movie. I was like, what? You've butchered it.
But...
It was, yeah.
We love Angela's introduction in the book series. You asked me if I could tell you this, you asked me if I would tell you this, but you never actually asked me to tell you this.
Yes, it was awesome. It was such an amusing moment between her and Brom, and it was one of the things I was...
Aragorn. Looking,
no, Brom. Brom was asking.
Good point.
And
yeah.
I was really looking forward to seeing that moment and seeing Angela in this book, in this movie that they were bringing out, and it ruined it all, and I was like, what? Angela was so awesome.
Anyway, we get to...
But she's like Angela.
Just before this woman comes along, Rand also is a little curious about the stable hand Much, you know, thinking he might be a dark friend and he's
kind of... Yeah, we already went over that. Next.
Okay, Min. Yeah. Yes, Min. All right. So, by all means.
Oh, well, I just love her because she's fascinating. She's one of those characters who can tell you things... doesn't necessarily explain the meaning or more than what she possibly understands. I mean, she says she doesn't understand it, but who says she doesn't, you know? Just because she says doesn't mean she hasn't got inklings or thoughts on what it could be. And she plays with him. Mm. You know, he's asking about what she sees or what she is, what she sees, how she knows things. He's cautious. But... when he realizes what she is, that she can see patterns in the design and what she's capable of seeing, he asks what she sees, knowing what it is he's asking, but leaving it until he actually asks. That's where the Angela thing comes in.
Fair point.
Because she knows what he's asking, but she won't give it to him until he asks. And that's.
And it's also interesting to note that she's one of the few people in Baelon who actually knows who Moraine is.
More because she had no choice about it, because she could see her pattern, she could see her design.
Her aura.
Her aura, yeah.
Of sorts.
Yeah, it's kind of like a seeing aura thing.
It's kind of aura, but like a weird precog kind of
aura deal. Slash future. And the
that's what I'm saying, precog.
And it's interesting because, especially with the water, I mean, like, he's got a baby in his future somewhere.
Well, we'll get to that.
And that's weird. But going through, I loved reading it, and I was like going through them several times, wondering what the heck everything is, you know? And how they're all, you know, he mentions them to some people, and it's like, oh, cool, that sounds like a ruby dagger. I like that idea.
But they each
have something different, too.
Yeah, they do.
They're not the same.
And before they actually get to that, I mean, before she actually reveals that part of it, she is a little cautious about him, but realizes that he's not the kind of person who would go running to the Children of Light, who, it wouldn't surprise me, end up being a bit of a major threat. I mean, right now, we're just getting a bit of an inkling as to who they are, and we'll talk more about them a little later on in the chapter. And she does say that she sees pieces, pieces of the pattern, and it's, you know, again, like a, almost a weird precog kind of thing. She doesn't quite understand what she sees. They're very odd, premonitions, I suppose.
Well, she talks about what rumours that she's heard about Two River Folk, how they act all friendly and stuff like that, but they're basically like a hornet's nest. You rile them up and they sting you real bad. Or she doesn't say hornet's nest, but she's described it as something else. Like, you know, wooden the jokes that I've heard are wooden-headed shepherd herders. But she's actually also, you know, heard about how they're friendly, but they're strong as stone and things like that. And if you mess with them, they're not, if they don't become very pretty kind of thing.
So let's talk about some of these, you know, precog kind of things that she has. She starts with Master Andro, the water.
I have to say, I like, you know, when she was saying how all their different things, it also brought to mind the fact that, okay, well, they're all having, all three of them are having the same dream, right? And if you recall in earlier chapters, Moraine is teaching, when Rand overhears,
Moraine teaching Egwene,
the history, there was more than one guy who was
capable of using the one power.
Yeah, but also there was a group of them who tried to wield it, get more power from it, right? And as a result, released this darkness of a sort. And also brought an imbalance to it, and making it so that any male who then in the future has this one power also goes crazy by it,
because attempts to use it goes a little nuts
because it's been tainted. Yes. Right now there was more than one. Now my thinking is that these three guys in their pre-past were a part of that group, that they,
there's a theory,
they were a part of that group, and as a result, whenever they're, like, for lack of a better word, reincarnated, or their souls come to their new life and things like that, they slowly but eventually recall, or with the help of the Dark One, recall bits and pieces, and as a result, either, I'm curious as to whether or not they're going to make it worse or better this time round. So that's a theory, but it's kind of, you know, from what we know so far to links and things like that, the fact that the Dark One is saying, you know, do you remember, are you him? Obviously one was stronger, one was more tempted than the others, one sort of led the others, which could be Rand, or dragon, as it were. I'm just saying, like, you know, it could be
Loghain the dragon,
it could be several different people.
No, good point. Oh, no, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're reincarnated, and every time they are, they either make it worse, or they eventually go mad.
Well, it kind of gives credence to the whole Wheel of Time.
Exactly.
Because the cycle just keeps recycling.
Cycling, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to some of these.
And also the whole point of the fact that he's saying that he can't be destroyed. I'm just going to have your power back anyway, so I can't be defeated. When time stops, I win, kind of thing. You know? I'm just saying.
Yeah. All right, so let's get to some of these you know, kind of weird precog type you know, kind of things.
I have a lot of theories. I told you I know.
And it's fine. And by all means.
Anyway.
In fact, I wanted to talk about Master Andra's thing now.
Okay.
To try and see what the theories are there. Because Master Andra, the water or...
his was very interesting, wasn't it? It was lots of things. And it was blurred and blended together.
It was three. Seven ruined towers around his head. A babe in a cradle holding a sword. Now, I'm curious. I mean, first of all, I'm wondering if there's any relation between the water and Rand and Tam. I'm wondering if there's a relationship between the water and Tam, maybe. Because if you recall, earlier on in the book, we found out that the way...
Tam might not even be his name. He does recognise the sword. That sword is obviously something of significance.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, and he doesn't believe that he's just randomly come across it. But there is also the fact that, I don't know, because he doesn't really recognise him, because the water was in Tam's room. and he doesn't recognize him at all. Doesn't give any recognition that him. So I'm
not just even that, but I still think that, there could be, but not in that way. Not blood relation, but maybe similar in the same army.
Like cousins or something?
In the same kind of army kind of thing, maybe?
So it's not blood relation, you're thinking. You're thinking it's in training.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I mean, because granted, who remembers everyone they went to high school with?
Yeah, but he's a warder. He was a soldier.
Yeah, so is Tim, after a fashion.
A warder. Not a totally different craft.
Not really. I mean, yes. Granted, it's like the difference between a crusader and a knight.
Hence, therefore, in a different training program.
Not disputing that, but I'm just thinking that that there could be some relation to them. They may have been fighting on the same side or something. Maybe. Don't know. But going into theories that, because a babe in a cradle holding a sword seems to me to be somewhat similar to how Rand came into the picture.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's related to it in any way. It just could be that his destiny and his future has to do with protecting... the past could be the Broken Towers.
Yeah.
It could also be the fact that he is destined to protect this child, whomever this child is.
Fair point, yeah.
In the future, or in the present. It could be many different things. What are the broken towers all about? We haven't heard of any towers per se at present moment, yet there are apparently
There's one tower that we're aware of.
Well, yeah, but there's seven
which that are broken. Which has come up in their kind of dreamscape vision type thing that they've been having.
Yeah.
So who knows, one could be that. Alright, so after Andro, we get to the Gleeman.
You just gotta skip over what she sees with everyone?
No, Gleeman's next.
Oh, right, okay, sorry, I thought you were talking about, actually bumping into one. I was gonna say, whoa, never mind.
The strongest images around the Gleeman are a man, not him, juggling fire and the White Tower. Interesting kind of thing. I mean, I'm picturing a little model kind of White Tower here.
Someone's juggling something and...
Yeah.
He's at the White Tower. I'm curious as to what the White Tower is, though. Is it a symbol of power?
Isn't that where you're in Tar Valon?
Yeah, maybe.
The White Tower, I think, could be in one of two places, and because I don't recall specifically if it's mentioned where it is at this point. Either it's where the Amelin seat is in Tar Valon, or it could be near where the dragon sits. One of the two.
So he could just be the person that tells the story.
Maybe. But juggling fire?
I'm curious as to why he's so entwined. It could be because he just loves a great story and won't leave.
Think about it. The best stories are from life experience.
Mm.
You know, you get... Someone, heard that she heard that I heard, that kind of thing, and those stories end up not being so good, whereas the ones where I lived through this, this is what I saw. I was not an actual participant, but I was with the people who were the key,
were the key players. He's kind of like the, Ian Irvine stories where, in one particular, Between Worlds, I can't remember the series, but it's told from the teller's story.
Yeah.
And he experiences everything.
Yes.
And he's the main character.
Main observer.
And the main observer. And he tells his story. And it's so horrible. And it is riveting. But it's so horrible because it's put in the legendary archives or great prophecy stories or whatever they call them. And then he gets kicked out. Because the story holder at that present time hates and detests him. And he's not allowed to tell stories anymore. He's not... All that work that he's done is all gone. But it's a similar thing. I can see him being the person that tells this amazing story for everyone in a court. Not as a court jester, but next to one, maybe.
I don't see him as an entertainer. Not in that way. Not
in a royal court?
I see him as a storyteller. You know, and some and the historian and a historian of sorts. The juggling, it's not him that's doing that though.
No, but that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm saying that maybe he's in a court, in a royal court, telling these stories because, or telling this story because there's a juggler.
Don't take the juggling literally. I'm thinking it's more figurative in terms of
that he's dancing on fire and he's
between a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. Maybe, yeah.
I don't really see a juggler being between a rock and a hard place, though. I see them more as a jester, more as an entertainer, but he's not the one holding it. Do you get what I mean? That's what I'm saying. I think it's more of a court thing. Anyway. Maybe.
All right, next we move on to Matt, who is the big curly-haired fellow, and we've got a wolf, a broken crown, and trees flowering. Interesting kind of mix there for him. I do see Matt, we know, is a trickster of sorts. He loves to play pranks, and we'll come to one after we've finished talking about men. He's always been only being the trickster, and I don't see him being a leader. I see him as being a follower and someone who is, but someone who loves to play around. And but he has got that protectiveness about him, which is where I'm thinking the wolf comes in. The broken crown, I think, is because I don't think he's got that leadership in him. I could be wrong. And the trees flowering is again part.
It's going to be growing. I reckon it's a part, a symbol of like he's growing. He's going to grow.
He's developing.
He's going to become stronger and better.
Yes.
Like, coming to himself.
Yes. Perrin, we got a red eagle, an eye on a balanced scale, a dagger with a ruby horn, and a laughing face.
Can I just say that the water is very interesting because...
All right, backtracking.
It's also the fact that she's noted that he is... While those are the strongest ones that she sees, she also sees more, and it's really hard to sort of see... the water's fate or future, or as it were, because there's so many of them, and so it's so diverse. So he's definitely one of those characters that it's hard to predict where he's going
to
go.
And the same applies to all of it, though.
But it's more certain. Men like him, you understand that there's always images overlapping one with another. So, you know, she's saying that there's too many variables, but they're the strongest ones. See, whereas with the Gleeman, she knew that the strong images were those things.
So and there are others there as well.
Yeah, there are others for all of them. Yeah. But the stronger, they're stronger, they're more dominant, it's more like they're more fated to happen. Do you get what I mean? Like, yeah. So it's
depending easier, on choices.
It's easier to predict where a certain person's going to go based on their personality type, because that's their drive, that's their instinct to naturally do those things. And so therefore, while there may be many varying options, the strongest ones that you see are the ones most likely to happen because of their personality, their type of style and career and whatever.
I like the description of Perrin's one there, which I started to go into, being red eagle, an eye on a balanced scale, a dagger with a ruby, and a laughing face. The first three, the eagle, the balanced scale, and the dagger with a ruby, and the horn, I find to be quite appropriate for him, because if you look, I don't know how many parallels there are going to be between what Perrin from Lord of the Rings experience as opposed to Pippin from Lord of the Rings as opposed to Perrin from this... but I am seeing parallels between the stories, and in that sooner or later, I think Perrin is going to need to make a choice. That there's going to be some key choice that he's going to need to make, which is going to determine the fate of something. And on the one hand, you've got, say, the Red Eagle... which is, you know, he's going to be... You know, what eagles love to explore. They love to kind of view the big picture, because they actually fly quite high and can see quite a long way. So they're what I call big picture type animals. And the dagger with the ruby and the horn, you know, are things that, you know, kind of deem with royalty to a point. I mean, because they're all...
More like he's able to announce. He's able to see and therefore...
Warn.
As a result.
Mm. And the laughing face, I think, is that...
He's still going to be... I hope it's still that he's still going to be able to eventually keep his humour.
Yes. Big time. That's my kind of hope. Because while they're all going to grow in their own different ways throughout this adventure and throughout this story, they're all going to develop different talents, different skills, and come more into their own kind of things. There are base traits that I hope... maintain or improve into, and in this case, that he still keeps his smile.
Yeah, but if you think about it, he is able to observe from afar. He's able to see things, and I mean, you'll be able to see that in a way with later on when you see his character. He's the type of person that is playful, but he's also able to see and sneak. I mean, like, he's sneaky. I mean, how many times has he been able to do a play a trick on someone and not be pointed out to, and like, oh, it was him. Yeah. But but the other thing is, there's no way they're going to be able to do it in a big city. But they know in the country. They know in the country because they know him and small they know town. What he's like. Small town, it's going to be harder to hide, right? But the fact that he's not actually caught in the act. Mm. It's just that they assume that it's him because that's his personality. They can't prove that it was him, though. Do you see what I mean? So he's kind of like a big picture thing already. You can see the beginning and know, okay, this is the perfect trick, you know.
Now we get the big question. I can see him using those
talents for other things.
Rand asks, what about me? And his... And his one is actually quite varied. Because you've got a sword that isn't a sword, a golden crown of laurel leaves, a beggar's staff, you pouring water on sand, a bloody hand and a white hot iron, three women standing over a funeral bier with you on it, black rock wet with blood. And he said, all right, that's enough. That is essentially a life story right there. And who knows what order it's in.
I find it interesting that it's a sword that isn't a sword.
Well, here's one. All right, next reference. Babylon 5. On this one, there's a race in there called the Vorlons. And they have a saying that understanding is a three-edged sword. And it took a while for me to realize, or at least both me and Sheridan, who's a kind of captain in that series, to realize what that particular saying meant. Your side, my side, and the truth. And the sword that isn't a sword could very easily be, this...
The two sides are in the middle.
Yeah.
The truth.
Could be the way that the way...
Saying like a judgment. He stands in judgment, and he needs to, because the very next thing is a crown, is a golden crown of laurel leaves, which is usually representation of a winner, in a competition. But in Roman times, that's what they would crown them with laurel. Laurel leaf. But in this case, it could represent royalty. Or that he is going to be ruler of something, so it could be that he's destined for that chair.
The next particular sentence, though, a beggar's staff, either a reminder of where he came from, possibly. Or it could be kind of saying that he loses everything as well, possibly. Going from, because it, you know, having those two things happen one after the other, golden crown, beggar's staff, I mean, that's, you know, complete opposite ends of the
scale there.
You pouring water on the sand could just be
a moment in time that's obviously significant at that point in time,
mm-hmm.
and not realize, you won't realize that significance until it occurs.
Bloody hand in a white hot iron. Another moment in time. Three women standing over a funeral bier with you on it.
His death.
Yes. A black rock wet with blood. Well, maybe the Dark Tower.
Could be. Again, another moment in time.
Hmm. But yeah, after that, and then most of all, I see lightning around you, striking at you, some coming out of you. And that, to me, is a symbol that his life is in chaos. That it's still extremely open. You have got a lot of paths ahead of you, and it's, you're causing some of them. You know, there's influence, you know, things which you are causing in terms of taking steps down some of these paths, but there are also other people's paths or other things that are influencing you.
Or that are striking you.
That are affecting you.
Choice.
But after that, they essentially go their separate ways.
I find it interesting that she's saying, I don't know what any of it means except one thing. You and I will meet again. And this is where I'm sort of like, yeah, I love that part. Because she also says that him and Egwene, while they do love each other,
are attracted to each other.
They're not, or that they have feelings for each other more.
Yeah.
That they're not, it's not going to go the way he wants. She's warning him. It's not going to go the way you want. She is going to choose this. And she is going to be Aes Sedai, whether you like it or not. And you're not going to change her mind. She is going to choose it. And as a result, it's not going to go down the path that you want it to go down. You're destined. It's almost like you're saying, she's warning him, like, you're destined for someone else. And I have to admit, in that moment, I was like, I'm curious as to whether or not she is the one that's destined for him, and she finds it curious, and him curious, because she's finding it interesting how she would actually fall in love with him, as it were. That's a possibility.
Maybe.
It could be. I mean, they're definitely going to meet again.
Yeah.
That she does know.
And given the kind of role that she started playing here with her introduction, it does not surprise me at all.
No.
Because she seems like the recurring, I'm here to shake things up kind of character. Yeah. Sometimes in an amusing way, but definitely in a
what the hell next
kind of way as well.
Yeah, but she's also given him a warning as well.
Yeah.
She has given him a warning about Egwene choosing
be careful.
It's more definite.
Essentially, be careful because if you try, it's going to break your heart.
Yeah.
You know, and that I'm just warning it's, you may have these feelings, but it's not going to be strong enough to break all barriers, so to speak. It's not that kind of love. It's not going to get that far.
And that makes me think maybe that's what the beggar thing is all about.
Maybe. What? She still...
No, he's begging for her not to do it.
Oh. Maybe. Actually, fair point. I haven't thought about that.
It may be totally off. It could mean something totally, and it could be, they could just be more symbolic gestures as well as to moments and events in time, or it could be something literal as there is a bigger staff that he's going to do something with.
Anyway, so after that, they essentially go their separate ways. As he leaves, Min says, does a whole crazy laugh thing. Go then, you won't escape, which freaks him out because the same thing that the Dark One said, or Baelzamon said to him, in his dream as well. But after that, he goes and essentially tries to get lost. Get lost in the city. While he's wandering around, and he sees merchants, traders, people of all kind of walks of life, still clamped in like sardines. But as he's wandering around, he's also noticing, we got paved streets, which would never happen in a small country town like Emmonsfield.
I love her parting words. Run if you want, but you cannot escape from me. It's almost like she's, she's gave him a quizzical look, almost like she didn't understand either that they would be meeting again. And then, he's like, well, why wouldn't we? I'm kind of be coming back this way to go home. kind of thing.
It's like, she's not going to be there. You're going to meet again at some other point in the future.
And that's why she's laughing, because, you know, it's like, well, that's not where I was thinking, but okay.
So after they separate and he's wandering through the city, he...
Does a lot of observation.
And, you know, the various kind of wares and stuff that are around there.
He's looking at the wares and he's wondering why people are giving him, the merchants are giving him looks. And he's like, he was about to tell him off, and then he realised that this isn't his town.
Mm.
He is a stranger, and that's why they're giving him the looks. And it was kind of funny.
I always found that to be very... I mean, in a lot of science fiction shows that that I watch, the term alien is used for anyone that is not human. When, in a lot of ways, aliens should be... humans are aliens as well, if you reverse it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'll just use, say, Star Trek is a nice simple example because that's my, you know, favourite show. For a human to go, you know, to land on planet Vulcan, for example, Vulcans would be the natural inhabitants of that planet, and the human would be the alien.
Exactly.
You know, it's the same kind of situation here. You know, Rand's gone down to the city and just realised, hey, I'm the alien.
Yeah, I'm the stranger. They don't trust me.
Exactly.
And it was weird for him. He found it like odd. He was like, oh, okay, right, but I get it. He was about to tell him off because it's like, hey, you know, you can trust me kind of thing. And then he realised, well, hang on, they don't know me from a bar of stove.
Exactly. Now, as he's wandering around and noticing that everyone is dressed in their fineries and whatnot, he sees someone who is not quite dressed the same way.
Yeah, well, he obviously...
dressed in rags and certainly not doing so well. You know, essentially, you know, kind of my image of a generic homeless person. And took him a minute, but he realised that it's Master Fane, a.k.a. the peddler or trader from Emmons Field. And he is like, what the? We thought you were dead.
I mean, when I was reading this part, I'm like, don't tell him, don't tell him, don't tell him.
Well, we'll
don't
get, tell him. We'll get because to that then,
you could just so see it. Oh, you could so see it and the naivete that he has. You can see what's happening.
You're jumping the gun by about 30 seconds.
The conversation.
First of all, Master Fane tries to get away for a little bit, then tries to run away, but he managed to catch up to him in an alley.
They're able to have a bit of a conversation
in terms of what's happened and what's happening. And
he's saying, if you go back to the Two Rivers, you'll find that your horse is there and you'll be fine.
And not only that, but you know, it's me, it's Rand.
Yeah.
You know, don't you remember me kind of thing? You know, we all thought that the Trollocs had taken you. It's like, no, don't mention them. Don't talk about them. Shut up.
Because the light people are there, right?
The white cloaks, otherwise known as the Children of Light. Mm. And he's like, hold on, why would they bother us? But if you come back, come back to the inn with us. You know, you'll, everyone will be so happy to see you, so glad to see you.
And I'm sure Maureen will help you get back to the Two Rivers. And he's yeek! Like, the Aes Sedai is here. It's so, yeah. But you can so see. You knew straight away that he was going to go run into the light.
We don't know that yet.
Oh, it's so happening, dude.
We don't know that yet.
First of all, he runs away because he's freaked out about an Aes Sedai. He sees someone who was in the Two Rivers, where an Aes Sedai was, and runs away from him because of the Trollocs, right?
Yeah.
So he doesn't want to be associated with anyone who has gone near a Trolloc. He doesn't want to be associated with anyone who's gone near an Aes Sedai.
Yeah.
Because he knows that the Children of the Light are going to kill him, because anyone who has been... they're going to be considered a friend of the dark or whatever the heck the term they use, and that they're going to be kicking him out or killing him or whatever it is they do, right? So he doesn't want to be related to anyone. He doesn't want anyone to know the situation or overhear the situation. So he runs away. But also, there's the fact that when he realizes he's not going to, and when he realizes that the Aes Sedai is here, he's thinking, I've just lost all my wares. They would pay me for the information. And so he gets, where are you staying? how long are you going to be there for?
Mm.
Hello? How is this not a, oh, cool, excellent, I'm going to go to the Children of the Light now and just dob in where you are so I can get my money back so that I can start peddling and trading again. The idiot now doesn't realize, though, that as soon as he says that an Aes Sedai is there, then he may not be, he may not actually get a reward like he wants because he's probably going to be killed because he was associated and knows an Aes Sedai.
And thank you for taking the words out of my mouth.
Because, but isn't that like any idiot that does that sort of thing? And Rand's just as much of an idiot for telling him.
How funny. I'm just recounting the Xena episode I watched yesterday.
Okay.
But anyway.
They're both idiots here, but anyway. Yeah. He's the bigger idiot. Personally, I think it's Rand because he doesn't realise.
Well, he thinks, yeah, Evan Field, I can trust this guy. He's from my hometown.
No, he's not. He's the peddler.
Yeah?
He comes to the town and leaves.
Well, I'm just thinking that may have been Rand's kind of mindset. Last time I saw him was at home. Home was wasn't exactly in the best of conditions, and we thought the Trollocs had, had taken you, but glad to see you're alive. Here's all the information you want to know about what's going on now.
Yeah, fair enough, but then there is the promise, promise me you won't tell her, she frightens me.
And that's not too surprising, because if you remember...
Oh, please.
It's not surprising, because if you remember that for people in Emmons Field, hearing of an Aes Sedai, it was like an omen of death.
He's not from there.
He's from that area.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
No, he's not. You know, the peddler is not from there.
I know he's not from Emmons Field specifically, but he hangs around that area.
He hangs around any area. He's in the city, for crying out loud. He's a peddler. He goes everywhere.
Even so, the mindset of hearing about an Aes Sedai was essentially an omen of death.
But I'm saying that he's using it also because he
wants... To manipulate?
Yes. He's not an idiot. He loves telling stories, right? He loves the crowd. He loves the telling. He loves the attention.
Fair point.
Right? He knows that if he says it, that it's going to happen.
Well, we'll see what happens in the next chapter on that one. I'm not doubting you, but I'm just saying we don't know conclusively yet.
Oh, it's so happening. Anyone who says it's not is an idiot.
I'm not saying that it's not. I'm just, yeah, but anyway. So, after that conversation and...
Which was very brief. He runs off.
Rand's kind of promised, I won't say anything to the Aes Sedai.
He tries to convince him to come back, and he's like, she won't.
No, that's fine. I'm gone. And he dashes off. Rand tries to chase after him, but actually, as he runs away, bumps full on into Matt, a big friendly giant. I've just got to ask, if they ever did this into a movie, I'll tell you the kind of person I'm picturing for Matt right now.
Okay. And a specific actor.
Yeah.
Okay. This will be interesting.
Jason Momoa, otherwise known as, for those of you who have watched Stargate Atlantis, Ronan.
No, he's
He's got that prankster in him. If you've ever watched him on a couple of different talk shows or whatnot, he's got that prankster in him. I can see him pulling off a decent Matt.
I don't know. I don't really see Matt as a big, friendly giant. I mean, like, he's got some muscles probably, yeah, sure, from working in the forge, but, you know, I don't really see him as Ronan. Ronan's, like, more intimidating.
Yeah, so's Matt.
Not really. Well,
so it depends on the scenario. Matt can be if he wants to be, but he's more, I agree, he's more the prankster type personality.
Yeah, he's more of a prankster than a...
But I can see, but Jason's got that in him.
Yeah.
Seriously, I've got to show some YouTube videos of him, because I do see that in him. But anyway,
I've not really seen him in those roles. He's always been the intimidating person.
Hmm.
The leader, the... They all talk about the roles he's been in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they all show him intimidating.
Not all of them.
Most of them.
No, well, anyway.
Skipping on.
Matt and Rand gives Matt a bit of a rundown. I just saw, Pat Unfane, and, a brief conversation, rah, rah, rah.
Promised him we wouldn't tell Maureen about the fact that he was there. Matt agrees. Another idiot.
And also, there were dead rats all over the inn this morning. And they, talk about the dreamscape. Rand's just now. And he also talks a little bit with him about men. The conversation he had there. And
I do love how Matt automatically says, "No, not him, not her. Like, we're not telling her."
Yeah.
But we Tom. Yeah, I'm okay with Tom kind of thing because we need to talk to someone.
And now after that, we get our first look at the Children of Light. And the way I'm picturing them is, kind of like the Knights Templar.
This is also where...
That kind of get-up?
Maybe. As a little...
Breastplate, steel, conical hats.
Templars, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah.
And we've got... three of these guys walking down the street. Even though it's busy, everyone's making sure to give them some room. I'm going to let them through.
More like Assassin's Creed Templars, the very first one.
Yeah, that's exactly.
But not the later ones because they're more adventurous and stuff. Or the robe
people. Matt. Oh.
This is also.
Here's what I've got to say, Matt. The water did say four words to you. Keep a low profile. I repeat.
He did.
Keep a low profile.
He did.
Yeah.
It's Rand who didn't.
What do you mean it's Rand who didn't?
It's Rand who didn't.
No, Matt.
Matt never got caught. Matt, they didn't even know Matt was there.
Look, someone played a prank. You get...
Oh, please. They would never have known if Rand had not laughed his head off and looked straight at them and done exactly what everyone else had done and decided to laugh inwardly.
I mean, just to kind of recap...
No, well, if he'd followed Matt so that they could have laughed together in the house, unknown, unseeing, they would have gotten away with it.
Just to kind of recap what happened a little bit is that there were some barrels which Matt used a sling to knock over so that everyone...
Well, knock the peg out that was keeping them up, so they rolled down.
Yep. And they kind of went all over the place, got mud everywhere.
Yeah, they managed to avoid
including on these Children of Light. And Matt managed to get himself out of sight, leaving his buddy Rand holding the bag.
Yeah, well, he was an idiot for not moving as well.
He didn't know what the hell Matt was doing.
Oh, and please,
he was stunned at what happened.
And also amused by it.
Amused, I'm not disputing that, but also, stranger in a strange land, he didn't quite realise maybe I should get out of here. He just thought, another prank. Yeah, this is what Matt does. Mm. And it's not until, they start coming over to him, he's like, oh crap. Men kind of surround him.
This is where the whole... I think this is where the dreamscape is starting to sort of manifest some of his inner... the inner workings. Because he's
little bit, experiencing possibly, yeah.
a cold, but I also think it's more than that. I think it's actually like the magic in him or the essence of past lives coming through.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's starting to channel... who that person was in or this people. Moment.
Yeah.
Or people, yeah, in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
That he all of a sudden has this great confidence that he is someone who is able of importance and someone who is able to take
He's got that people. Kind of air about him and I agree. Yeah.
He's someone who can intimidate and influence and to not,
Yeah. Yeah. And he's, you know, they're initially trying to question him, who are you, where do you come from, and he's silent. He does, or not silent, but he's silent, but he doesn't give, or gives vague kind of answers. But it's not until the town watch.
He reveals the sword, and they see
the sword.
The sword, and the fact that it's got
the heron.
The heron on it.
Yeah.
And that backs them up. It's not so much him and his stance and confidence, while that does give them a little wariness. It's the sword that actually does. And the leader of the group, I suppose, is questioning it. But the other two are like, well, hang on, dude. With the way this dude is acting and the fact that he's got that sword, no, we're backing off.
Yeah.
But he's not. And it's not until the guards come that the leader then backs off.
Yeah. So, after that, start to make their way to, start to make their way back to the inn, but they realise, hold on, where the hell are we? And it's not until they bump into Tom the Gleeman on the way back that they bump into Tom the Gleeman that they're able to make their way back. But they also, and here's where they kind of sit down and give Tom the rundown. This is what we've been talking, what's been happening to us, say in the last 12 hours.
Well, he also tells, he does tell her about Min as well.
Yeah.
I know he does that in the last 12 hours.
That's what I'm saying. That, you know, he gives him the rundown in terms of what's happening.
Technically, he says that before the practical joke. He does, Rand does tell him about Min before the practical joke.
This is Tom, I'm saying, though. Gives Tom the rundown.
Yeah, but he, okay, fine. I like Matt's response. A dagger with a ruby. Ah, I like that.
Anyway, so they give Tom the rundown in terms of what's
the dream,
what's been happening, and where was it? Yeah, they mentioned that Balzamon is kind of like Voldemort.
Yeah.
He who shall not be of the story. He who shall not be named, because as soon as he says it, he's like, don't even say that name where strangers can hear, or not even where a might hear. It's a very dangerous name, even where the children of light are not wandering the streets. It's essentially he who shall not be named, kind of name, because it kind of freaks people out a little bit.
They list off the people that he mentions, though.
Yes.
That are being used. Yeah. And when he hears them, they're dangerous names, to be sure.
So these are nearly
as dangerous as the other, he says, to the point, one way or another, they're all dead except one, which was Logan.
Who's the current kind of... Yeah. I don't know, the way he pictures like Hitler of previous ages.
Maybe.
For lack of a better word.
We don't know their story, though.
No, we don't. But with the fact that they're dangerous names and wrong people over here and whatnot, it's kind of like Hitler of previous ages. You go into Germany and you raise your arm like this in what the kind of Nazi salute was, you get yourself arrested. It's a dangerous name and a dangerous thing to get to... Because Germany does not want to remember that dark time in their history. They, recognise it and whatnot, but it's, certainly not the most pleasant of times for them. And
I love the way he describes them, though, that they were men. They were still men, but they were men who shook the pillars of heaven and rocked the world with to its foundations, basically.
Yes. Yep.
And it doesn't matter, forget about them, they're dust now. But it's more a case of, well, wow. Obviously, they had huge impacts.
For them to still be remembered
in that way.
Yeah. And my guess is negative impacts, for that matter. Mm. Now, after that, in the very next bit, they talk about, the White Tower killed them. Again, assuming that they were the Hitlers of the time. It was like, you know, they were taken out by the good guys. But used? No, I cannot see that. The light knows the Amelin seat as Pozenov going, but I can't see that, which I'm finding interesting. It's almost as if, at least the way I'm reading that, that Thomas is denying the existence of Satan.
No, I think what he's saying is that it is true that they had a huge impact in their day, in their days of time or whatever, you know, but he can't really see them as being influenced or used, and it's possibly because they were so influential themselves that he can't really see them as being used or puppeted by someone.
Mm.
And now, whether or not that is used by, I suppose, it could be used by an unimaginary person, because like you're saying, these dreamscapes, Tom wasn't a part of it. He couldn't see those, and you can't really see those or know that they're being affected by someone until they tell you about it. So I suppose there is that possible influence. But as far as evidence of a person puppeteering them, it's not there because they were so influential. I don't think he's denying anything. I think he's more going based... He's more of a factual person. In that case, he's more saying, okay, given what I know and given what the stories say, I don't really see them being the type of people that could be manipulated because of their personalities, because of their influence, because of what they did.
Maybe, and I can understand. I get that logic. Now, here's where we get our first glimpse of the title of this book.
I'll also, hang on. He also says that, I wouldn't recommend telling.
Well, yeah, that's after.
Either. Okay, fine.
That's after. That's the very next thing.
Okay.
But here's where we get, where the title of the book first makes its entry. And again, feel free to correct me, listeners. I'm happy to be correct from this point. But
well, it's set in the dreamscape.
And the eye of the this is Matt kind of talking. He said so many things, crazy things, and the eye of the world. What in the light is that supposed to be? And the Gleeman says it's a legend, and one that's is apparently a very big legend.
As big as the horn one. I don't have no idea what that one is.
Young men go hunting the Eye of the World the way young men from Ilion go hunting the horn. And he's not sure...
If it's legend or not.
Well, if it's legend or reality.
Yeah. But he has heard of it.
He's heard of it. He's heard the story, but we don't find out what the story is yet. And I agree that, you know, now's not the time. Because they're still...
Public.
Out in public a bit, and they're not... but it's...
He's listening.
Yeah. But it is something that I'm sure we're going to find out more of later on. But after that, they start to make their way back, because that's the last... Because they agree that they're not going to tell Moraine at this point.
To hold your peace. And I do like his wisdom. You know, I do like Tom.
Yeah.
You know, hold your peace and don't tell anyone for the time at least. Because you can always change your mind, right? Yeah. But once it's told, it's told.
Once the cat's out of the bag, the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, you can't stop it, right? So, you know, it's almost like he's the confidant. It's strange, right? A teller of stories being confidant.
Yeah.
Like, hello. I love telling things.
But they also agree.
It was a bit of a risk because in some ways it was like, wow, you know, he's a teller, but we don't know a great deal about him. And so there was this 50-50 chance that he could have gone, you know, oh, wow, another story to tell.
And no doubt he's possibly thinking that for a long time later.
Definitely he's going to tell it.
But he also is respecting their confidence to say, look, I'm not going to say anything. I recommend you don't either for this reason. It wouldn't surprise me if he recognises all this as being part of a great tale.
Yeah.
Of sorts.
That he's going to be recording for later.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, they make their way back to the inn. The first thing that happens when they get back to the inn, Perrin comes bounding down. And before Perrin gets much of a word out, they're just wanting to make sure that you didn't say anything, right? You shut up.
I love the way you say it. The other lad, do you think he would say anything? And Rand's like, no, he wouldn't say anything. And the other one's like, well, I don't think he would. And they're like, okay, let's pray that we're not too late. And he races off, right?
Yeah.
And the other, and he's looking behind the other two like, what are you doing? Let's get back.
Yep. So they, but Perrin's coming out, and yeah, the first thing they to say to him, please tell me you did not tell anyone about the dream. he's like, no, I didn't.
I literally just spoke an hour ago, but there's something else which I need to tell you. I love the expression "blood and ashes." Matt yelped.
Yep. After being told that, who is there?
I love the fact that she was able to get past everyone.
She who said the name.
I know. I love the mystery.
Oh, good.
But I just love the fact that she bugged him. Mm. She bugged the river man to take her across. With her and her horse.
Hey, it's Nynaeve, the wisdom from Emmons Field, just because Kylie wouldn't say it. Even though the writer already has at this point. But anyway, so Nynaeve's inside, and everyone's like, I'm picturing a kind of scene where everyone's mouths are open, you know, kind of drop their whatever they're holding kind of thing and stunned kind of, what the hell?
You know what I love even more? They're all like, yep, let's just stay out here for a little longer and wait until Maureen comes back before we go in. But I also love the way that Tom says, you know, I don't think she will be stopped until she has had her say. And if she is not allowed to have her say soon, it might be told in a way that will attract attention.
Yeah. That's
not wanted.
Which I'm finding very funny, considering what Matt just did. But anyway.
I know that Matt did it, but Rand was
I know.
Yeah.
Fall guy.
Yeah.
But they agree, you know, they look at each other, and the phrase here is much as if to face trolley, so I'm kind of picturing her walking into the principal's office.
She's a trollic in her own right, especially given the fact that she woke up the ferryman, paid him, and gave him long enough to get one other person to row. Not only did she get him to do it the same night that he obviously saw his ferry get sunk to the bottom of the river, but that's impressive power, yeah. Man. To get someone to get up out of bed, to row across the river at night, and also have someone rowing along, like, with a horse and stuff like that. Mm. That's just, yeah.
Well, and we all know that Nynaeve is certainly one to be reckoned with.
She is very influential in her own right.
And so the next chapter being titled The Wisdom. And based on this, we're definitely going to find out more about her story and more about what happened in Emmons Field after the crew left.
I would like to know what happens to Tam or what happened to Tam.
If there's more information on that, I'm sure that Rand would be asking the question.
Because Tam, there wouldn't be much because Tam would still be resting up in the inn, right? So there wouldn't be much progress, but the fact that he's still,
It'd want an update. Rand would definitely want an update on his... Well, his father. I know he's not a blood relative, but you know, there's still that relationship. Yeah,
he's still in denial about the fact that Tam's not his dad.
So it's kind of... the next chapter is going to be a...
And get an earful about what she thinks. I'm curious as to...
Why the hell did he go off with an Aes Sedai? I've got no doubt there's going to be that kind of a thing happening in here.
I am curious as to... I think that she would also feel slightly betrayed by Egwene because Egwene left.
Maybe.
And she was training her up to be the next wisdom. So there's that. I think that's going to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
There is also... Is Egwene there, maybe? Not at the inn. She might still be out.
Out and about, possibly.
Possibly. Yeah. But, the fact that that's definitely going to be addressed... It's whether or not she sees Moraine as a
threat.
Well, not necessarily a threat, but more as a respected person of a similar level to her. Like, you know, because you remember how half of them liked the Aes Sedai, or liked the fact that she was an Aes Sedai and respected her wisdom and her counsel. The other half did not.
Well, they were freaked out.
Yeah, yep. And I'm curious as to which side she falls on with that. So I'm curious as to whether or not, if that is the case, if she does fall on that other side, or on which, you know, whichever side she is, whether or not she would be influenced to accept the Moraine's wisdom, yeah. I guess, as
okay.
it were.
Interesting to see. All right, well, we've been going on for a little over an hour, so we do want to thank you listeners for sticking around for the duration of that chapter. If you do want to...
There was a lot to talk about.
There was. It was a very... Well, as far as Audible's concerned, it, you know, was an hour-long kind of chapter in and of itself to listen to. And reading it, it's certainly one of the longer chapters. Now, as far as... if you do want to contact us, you know, to provide comments or constructive criticism, you know, you can do so on my email address, which is warrior346@yahoo.com. Or on my Twitter feed, which is @warrior346. Or you can also leave some feedback on the Apple Store, on the Apple Podcast store there thing as well. Thank you very much for listening, and may the Wheel of Time keep on spinning.